Back together again, you and I, Tuesday, November 15th, 2022, on Connecticut Today. We featured former Connecticut Lieutenant Governor candidate Monty Frank on the next step toward possible ranked choice voting in the state. Heritage Foundation analyst and Marine Corps veteran Dakota Wood talked about the current readiness or lack thereof of the U.S. military. And Dr. Bradley Woodworth, an associate professor of history at the University of New Haven, returned to talk about a report of Russian missiles possibly hitting Poland. And we've had this gentleman on a few times before, primarily to talk about ranked choice voting, something that his party was promised would happen, or at least the effort would be put forth by Governor Ned Lamont, hence the Griebel-Frank party giving its cross endorsement to the governor in last week's election. Monty Frank is with us. Monty ran with the late Oz Griebel as Oz's lieutenant governor candidate 4 years ago. Monty, hi. It's Paul here again at WICC. Good to chat with you. How are you?
I'm doing well, Paul. How are you doing?
Good, good. Give us your post-game report here on what you thought of what happened last Tuesday on the governor's race, Monty.
Well, our candidate won, and we're thrilled about that. We endorsed Governor Lamont for re-election because of his strong pledge towards fairer elections, including his commitment to ranked choice voting. The governor is going to be introducing a bill in the next session that will hopefully move ranked choice voting forward in the state. And that's a significant boost to our democracy.
Monty, the version of ranked choice voting, now, is it correct? And I read an earlier report. Please correct me if I'm wrong. What races will that affect? I understand it's some municipal races for towns that want to do it, but what about the General Assembly? What about the governor's race? How widespread would this be? Do we know?
Well, we're essentially following the protocol that they did up in Maine, which is that initially ranked choice voting would only apply to the federal races. So the five congressional districts plus the two races for the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
It would also allow municipalities to opt into ranked choice voting for single offices.
Mm-hmm.
So, your mayor, your first selectman, that sort of thing. It gets complicated with the minority representation on various boards. So that's why the bill only targets single office races. But, we think that's significant. We believe that if we were to get that passed, and we are confident we will be able to, that the voters in the state will be able to kick the tires on ranked choice voting, see what it does. We think, based on our experience in other states, that the voters will really like it. And then we'll go back and seek to have ranked choice voting done, implemented for the General Assembly and the constitutional offices.
Yeah, see, in my thinking, Monty, I would love to see that if it's going to be for municipal offices and for, the federal elections, I think the easiest place, Monty, and this is just my opinion, you can agree or not, the easiest place that people overlook, Monty, to really make change in a state is away from the sexiness of the governor's race or Congress on a federal level, but the General Assembly races. And I think if you're going to do this, I sincerely hope that someday, if it does come to fruition, that it includes the state House and the state Senate.
Yeah, that's our goal. We think it would be a major improvement on democracy. It would produce more choices for voters, and voters like it, and they'll turn out more. One of the reasons we decided to go for the federal elections first, mm-hmm, is we knew that we had a strong supporter of ranked choice voting in Representative Hines. He has been a strong proponent of ranked choice voting for years and was one of the co-sponsors of the bill that was presented in the House of Representatives on ranked choice voting. So, that to us, plus we know a number of municipalities that want to do it, made it an easy choice to go that route in the first instance, just to, again, to allow voters to kick the tires, experience it, and then we can move it forward to the General Assembly and the constitutional offices.
Former Connecticut Lieutenant Gubernatorial candidate in the 2018 cycle, Monty Frank, with us. Monty ran with the late Oz Griebel in 2018. The Griebel-Frank party had chose a cross-endorsement this time around of Governor Ned Lamont, who won primarily with the specter that the governor promised to introduce or get whatever weight he could behind a movement for ranked choice voting here in the state. Now, Monty, you folks have been associated with the Serve America movement. I've talked about that in the past, but now you're getting together with what, a couple of other organizations to really try and give people a third alternative here in the U.S. Talk about that.
Yeah, there's been a real consolidation on the national level in the third party space. So the organization that I was affiliated with, SAM, or the Serve America movement, that was headed by David Jolly, former Republican congressman from Florida, that group merged with Renew America and the Forward Party. The name coming out of the merger is the Forward Party. Renew America, as you may recall, involved Christine Todd Whitman from New Jersey and the EPA, and Michael Steele and a bunch of other former Republicans. And the Forward Party was started by Andrew Yang. And so, you know, we've really got a situation where cats and dogs are coming together to try to work together to improve our democracy. And I'm so excited to be a part of it. I'm on the National Leadership Advisory Board of Forward. And literally at that meeting, there are a number of former governors, former congressmen, business leaders from all over the country who have come together not to develop a national platform based on ideology, but beyond the simple principle that there is a real threat to our democracy and we can elect candidates who are committed to improving our democratic process and fostering good government principles. And one of the key components of the plan is to implement ranked choice voting across the country, because that provides voters with more choices. It promotes a better electoral process and guarantees that the ultimate winner of the instant runoff that ranked choice voting is has the support of a majority of voters and not merely that of the largest or most active minority. So, you know, it's a real important drive. And I think over time, you'll start seeing Forward candidates being elected here in Connecticut and across the country at all levels, from, you know, your Board of Finances, Board of Selectmen, education boards, you know, all the way up to mayors, governors eventually, and national federal offices.
So your goal here, Monty, is to eventually give people, when they go to fill out those ballots once every 2 years, a valid third party or third channel here to say, hey, there's the R's and the D's, but maybe you want to look at these Forward candidates. Because, again, and I started my show earlier today with this, Monty, saying it's frustrating to me because you get all these people who say, hey, we need third-party candidates. We just need alternatives, right? But every cycle, it's the combined Democrat-Republican vote is 94, 95, 96%. I mean, to me, I don't know about you, to me, it's just continually frustrating.
It's very frustrating, particularly since over 60% of the electorate favors the third party. And most people agree that a third party, if you allow that, those choices will improve our democracy because it will allow a more robust debate on the issues. You know, I look at it this way. You know, I used to be a Democrat. I identify more with the Democratic Party than I do with the Republican Party, but I don't agree with everything in the Democratic Party. You know, when I go to a buffet, I may pick seven or eight things, out of the 20 that are on the buffet. But if you, the way politics have evolved, if you're an elected official and you're a member of that party, you're almost required to kind of buy the whole buffet.
Everything's a litmus test. That's why, Monty, the idea of a pro-life Democrat and a stern gun control Republican is almost non-existent.
Right. So where's my home right now, right? I am a fiscal conservative. I want to lower taxes. At the same time, I'm a strong advocate for greater gun violence prevention measures to protect the environment. And I'm pro-choice. So, I don't have a home in either party. And what's brilliant about Forward is it allows me to have those views and still have the support of the party, because the party cares more about good governance principles, accountability, transparency, ability to solve problems, to talk with other people in Congress or in the State House about how do we find solutions to the problems that are facing the greatest number of residents in our state. Right now, those problems are not being solved either under the Gold Dome in Hartford or in Congress. And as a result, we the people are suffering. So the Forward concept is to really embrace the greatest constituency and work towards restoring our democratic principles.
Check out forwardparty.com online, forwardparty.com. Monty, always good to hear from you. We'll check in down the road. Thank you, sir. Take care.
Thanks, Paul.
Appreciate it. Monty Frank there, like he said, identifies more with Democrats than Republicans, and he ran 4 years ago with a guy who obviously identified more some things on the conservative or Republican side, Oz Griebel, than he did with Democrats. And now the Serve America movement is morphing into a three-organization consortium calling itself the Forward Party. So Forward Party. .com. Check it out. Agree or not. What is the readiness, the state of readiness of the U.S. military? A lot of people, veterans or not, are concerned with that. Our next guest served America for 2 decades in the U.S. Marine Corps. He retired from the Corps as a lieutenant colonel in 2005. During his service, he served with a variety of operational units and in various high-level staff assignments. He is currently a researcher and writer with focusing on the military for the folks at the Heritage Foundation. Dakota Wood joins us. Dakota, hi. Good afternoon. It's Paul here at WICC. How are you?
Doing great. Thanks so much for having me on. It's a real blessing for me. So looking forward to chatting.
Well, thank you, sir. The readiness of the American military. A lot of folks, Dakota, debating this. Can we fight a single-front war? Can we fight a two-front war? Tell my listeners, give us a capsule here of what you think and likely you're hearing from some of your contacts still in the force.
Yeah, I know it'll sound alarming. We assess the current military as weak relative to U.S. global interests and our obligations and just the nature of war these days. You know, how much stuff it takes, how modern and how ready a force needs to be. So we publish an annual report. It's kind of like a report card. It's called the Index of U.S. Military Strength. This is our 9th edition. We released about a month ago, and looking at readiness reports, the age of equipment, and the size of the military services, we concluded that it would be challenged to handle one major conflict, like a Korea or something like that. So if something happens in Europe, and Russia, you mentioned possible attacks against Poland, but if we had to commit the military to Europe in any kind of major way, you wouldn't have much military left over to do anything else in the world. And I can give you, we had 700 footnotes in our military assessment chapter in this big book that we publish. Readiness rates, like I said, are down. Pilots aren't flying. Army units aren't able to train to the level that they should. The average age of an American fighter airplane, you know, an F-16 or F-15 is 32 years old.
Oh, come on. 32 years old. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Our tanker aircraft are in their 60s. Over half of the Navy ships are greater than 20 years old. In the Cold War, we had 580 ships in the Navy. Today, we have 292. So of those, maybe 100 are available on any given day. China alone has 360 ships.
So Dakota, where you know, we hear about these huge Pentagon budget allocations, or maybe they're not big enough. Where's the money going?
Well, a lot of the money went to consumables during 20 years of operations in Afghanistan and a dozen years or so there in Iraq. So fuel, munitions that were spent, vehicles that were blown up by roadside bombs. A lot of that money paid for current operations. Very little went into modernizing, you know, taking old equipment and replacing it with new equipment. So most of the stuff that the military has was actually bought during the Reagan administration in the 1980s, and it came into the force in the 1990s, right? So the stuff that we acquired, Abrams main battle tanks, F-16 fighters, the destroyers we have in the Navy, Arleigh Burks, began coming in the 1990s. That was 35 years ago.
Wow.
So we have elevated budgets. When you look at a percentage of the nation's gross domestic product, it's around 3.2% or so. The average during the Cold War was 5%, 5 to 6%. The current budget was an increase of about 4% over last year, but if inflation is running 8 or 9%, when you give them a dollar, it only buys 80%, you know, 80 cents worth of stuff. So it's just expensive. We've got global obligations. We just haven't dedicated money to replacing stuff with modern equipment that's more expensive than, let's say, a 1970s Raiden's counterpart.
Talking for a few minutes more about the state and the readiness of the U.S. military with a senior research fellow for defense programs at the Heritage Foundation in D.C., and he is also a retired U.S. Marine Corps lieutenant colonel, left the Corps in 2005. Dakota Wood with us for a few more minutes. Dakota, is the American fighting man still the best trained soldier in the world?
Well, we've got great people. I think they are the best people in the world. Trained is a different matter. Again, Cold War, an Air Force pilot would fly well in excess of 200 hours a year. Mm-hmm. Today, the average fighter pilot in the Air Force flies fewer than 120. And even in the frontline fighters, like the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter, some of those squadrons only get 75 hours a year. The Army is focusing its training at the company level. Companies make battalions, battalions make brigades. Very little training is done at the brigade level. So it's kind of like working your special teams on a football team or just your offensive line and defensive line separately, and then expecting on game day that they all come together as a cohesive unit. So we've got fantastic people, right? I mean, we're producing out of our basic training for enlisted officers, highest quality people. They're just amazing folks. But they get into the operating forces and the funding isn't there to train them as they would expect. And very few people are even eligible for military service today. Fewer than, I think, 1 in 4. It's like 23% of American youth are even eligible because of criminal records, substance abuse, obesity, health problems, et cetera. The Air Force is short. So many pilots, 650, I think, that their graduation rate from flight school is like 94%, 95%. So if you got a pulse, you're going to graduate from flight school to be a pilot. I mean, it's just amazing. So you've got good people.
Yeah.
They're just not able to train enough.
If we were to, Dakota, tomorrow enter an armed conflict with China, do we win?
No. And I hate saying that, but the military has conducted several war games. You have former senior commanders at the Indo-Pacific Command who have all expressed grave reservations about the nature of that battle. So remember, I mentioned the Navy ships. Only about 60 of those are in the Indo-Pacific at any given time. China has 360, plus all the shore-based stuff. China would be operating, say, 200 or 300 miles from the coast. We're operating 7,000 miles from home. So they'd be able to sustain operations and to take hits. You know, you got a really good ship and good people. The enemy only has to be successful once or twice and penetrating your defensive screen. You know, with an anti-ship cruise missile, you have to be perfect every time. So we would really be challenged to win in a major conflict. Now, if China decides to take Taiwan, you know, Taiwan's going to bristle with defenses. Japan might get involved, but they haven't thought about warfare since they lost in World War II. So it's really in doubt whether or not we would be able to win a war on terms that we would find acceptable.
Dakota, what about how we stack up against the Soviets? I know we have a bunch of nukes. Mm-hmm. They have a bunch of nukes. There's always been mutually assured destruction. But I know where the real heavyweight battle with us, Dakota, for years has been, and that has been with submarines. How do we stand there?
We have a terrific advantage in submarines. So the U.S. Navy is the world's finest. And we just really dominate in the undersea environment. China is getting much better. And to the extent that Russia has been modernizing, you know, applying its resources, it's really been in its submarine community. So we still have an advantage. That would be the one thing that we could really count on. But in aircraft and in new construction ships, China is just amazing, 212 ships to 360 in about 15 years. They're tripling the number of intercontinental ballistic missiles that they have here in the next year or two. Russia has many more types of warheads that could be delivered if you're talking about that nuclear field. And you mentioned the Cold War in the Soviet Union. You know, everybody grew up from the 1950s on in developing these capabilities. So deterrence was really understood. But you bring in new actors like China and North Korea, a near nuclear Iran, they don't play them in the same game. So it's a multi-actor field now, and the old deterrence notions really start to break down. So there's a lot of uncertainty there as well.
Hey, Dakota, one thing I want to chat on before we wrap up here. What's going on in space? Listen, the Chinese and the Russians have both said, we will take out your satellites. I think kudos to President Trump. One of the things I think he did well was to formally designate the U.S. Space Force to really focus on this. I mean, that could be nasty stuff, disabling our satellites. How do we stand there with space-based weapons?
Most of the satellite systems put into space by the U.S. were meant to have a lifespan of about 10 years. Many of them have now been into space for about 30 years or so. So they're performing magnificently, but three times as long as expected. And the demand for satellite services, you know, imagery and other sensors and communications and all that stuff, is just through the roof. And we just don't have the constellation that we would need to maintain operational, you know, capabilities if war happened. Now, what does war mean? Well, you can have a missile that shoots a satellite out of the sky. Both the Russians and the Chinese have shown the ability to do that. You can have special satellites that attack other satellites in space. Both of those countries have been investing in those capabilities. There's another thing called a parasitic satellite, where you develop this ability, you put up the thing to repair your own satellites or to maybe refuel it. But if you can do that, that microsatellite can attach itself to somebody else's and either, you know, as a parasite, you know, get information out of it or push it out of orbit or destroy it or something like that. So our competitors have invested heavily in these capabilities. We have not done similarly. So we have better capabilities on a global scale, but our defensive capabilities, I don't think, are up to the task.
Wow. Food for thought. Folks, check it out, heritage.org, heritage.org. You can get all this commentary and more and the report that our guest has talked about. Dakota Woods, Senior Research Fellow for Defense Programs at the Center for National Defense at the Heritage Foundation. He's a retired U.S. Marine Corps Lieutenant Colonel, left the Corps in 2005. Dakota, this has been very informative. Thank you. Take care, and we'll talk down the road.
Great. Looking forward to it.
Thank you. All right. There you go, man. Well, there's some stuff we're still doing well, he says. Submarine warfare. We got that down, but other stuff, got to catch up. Return guest, one of our go-to people on international affairs. He's an associate professor of history at the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of New Haven. He worked as a journalist in the Soviet Republic of Estonia and reported from the Baltics when the USSR collapsed back in 1991. We welcome back Dr. Bradley Woodworth today to talk about this news out of Poland here. Brad, good afternoon, sir. Good to speak with you again. How are you?
Hi, Paul. Thanks for having me back.
Well, thank you. Appreciate it. So what do you make of this, Brad? Somewhat conflicting reports, but the overriding theme here is that one or two Russian missiles may have landed in Poland. What are the implications here?
Yeah, well, I mean, first we do have to get confirmation for exactly what happened, right? That it wasn't the detritus from a Ukrainian defense missile. And so anything that we would go on to talk about as if it were definitely a Russian, a couple of Russian missiles, we would have to have that confirmed.
Sure.
Before we could talk in definite terms. But if we were then to go on with discussing what likely was two Russian missiles landing in NATO territory, right? That's the first time this has happened. And as you and your listeners know, all of the states, including the United States, that had signed this NATO agreement back in the 1950s, have pledged to the principle of collective defense, right? That's what helped us after 9/11. We had allies that sent people to die, right, to Afghanistan and to Iraq. So the Biden administration has already promised and reiterated today that we will abide by that treaty. And if a state attacks one of our allies, that we would respond. Well, nobody is going to jump to that kind of those kind of actions quite yet. So, yeah, you're right. This is a moment to study, figure out, you know, what's happening, and to also try to figure out, you know, why Russia would do this, because there's no military advantage. Right, there's no strategic purpose for sending two missiles into Poland and killing a few civilians. So what is it about? Right, that's what we'll sit down to figure out.
I mean, Brad, could it have been? I mean, would Putin come out and say, "Listen, we're not involved with Poland. This was a mistake"? Would it surprise you if he came out and said, "Listen, we're sorry. We're involved with Ukraine. We have our reasons for that, whether you like it or not. But we did not intend this to, you know, go into Poland." Or could it have been a provocation? Who knows?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I don't remember ever hearing those words coming out of Putin's mouth. No, I mean, if it is shown that these were Russian missiles, then it will have been intentionally done, and so you know we'll respond. But I think there are a number of reasons for why Putin could have done this.
Yeah. What do you think?
I think the first is to show the United States. Again, the United States is the strongest backer, the biggest supporter in military and also politically for NATO. That if the U.S. does not force and NATO really well push the Ukrainians to sit down at the bargaining table, then the Russians will be willing to engage in this very dangerous game of chicken and start lobbing missiles into NATO. I mean, Putin knows that no one wants to start another World War III. No one wants that. He's a lot more willing to run risks. I mean, he's in a pretty desperate situation. The Russians are losing the war on the ground in Ukraine. Just last week, they had to leave this major regional city of Kherson, a very important city, a port city, a city with that is in the hinterland of Crimea, which is really the centerpiece territorially of Putin's land grab in 2014.
So that must have been so Brad, that must have infuriated Putin, I would think.
To lose Kherson, absolutely. So Putin, it looks like an illogical act, right, to lob a couple of missiles into Poland, but Putin is not dumb, just the opposite, right? So he knows eventually there will need to be some sort of end game. Now, it's possible also that he is thinking that there could be a disagreement could arise between NATO allies. Already today, very early in the afternoon, The Estonians were a very small country, but a very, very dedicated supporter of NATO for their own for their own sense of security.
Mm-hmm.
Said that they are closely consulting with the Poles, and that they're in full solidarity and will give Poland everything they need. So maybe Putin's thinking that he could drive a wedge, somehow in between NATO, and that eventually that could. He's not sure. He's a very creative political actor, and so maybe he's thinking that down the road there could be. I mean, that would be ideal for him as a split. I mean, one thing to remember also is that Putin has been selling a split in NATO. Putin has been selling to his people now for a couple months that this is not so much a war, he calls it a military, a police action, right, in Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a war against Ukraine. It's a war against NATO.
Ah, yes.
And it's backward the United States. So he's been pushing that for a long time. So if he could get a division within NATO, that would be to his advantage.
Brad, also.
And then there's one other reason.
No, please finish up. Go ahead.
I think there's one other big reason that he's probably advocating for this. And it gets to the point you just made that not only is he angry about losing Kherson, but he's humiliated. And his force is pushed out.
Yeah.
So what I'm thinking that if he could deflect criticism or just push back against any sense in Russia that he's made a mistake overall and that his military is weak, if he could deflect through bellicosity, right, to show that we're tough and we'll show you how tough we are, we will launch these small attacks against NATO, and then if he could spin things, he's in complete control of the press, so if he could spin things well, he could not make this look like Russia is leaving this war with its tail between its legs, but is actually strong, that Russia's powerful and mighty, when actually it's just the opposite.
Yeah, they're dictating the rules here. Brad, final thing here. You've probably seen the reports, too, of, I guess, some of these missile strikes causing mass power outages in Moldova.
Yeah, also in Ukraine. Yeah, so, again, the Russian army on the ground can't do anything, but they do have this massive store of cruise missiles. These are war crimes, right? Because these missiles have no military function. They're killing, mm-hmm. right? And they're killing civilians. It's not hard to just go on social media and see just heartbreaking photos of young men and often young women, families that are being destroyed, young people and brilliant people with so much to give, not only to their own country, but the world. And dying in their 20s and 30s. And, of course, the cases among the Russian military as well.
Sure.
So these are war crimes that are being carried out. That is absolutely clear.
Brad, thank you so much for your insight. Welcomed, as always, Dr. Bradley Woodworth, Ph.D., Associate Professor of History at the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of New Haven. Brad, take care. We'll chat down the road. Thank you once again.
My pleasure.
Thanks. Brad Woodworth there.